Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. And I am now, hopefully, technology willing, joined live on the line with Joanne from the fabulous Our Match show on PIR. Can you hear me still, Joanne?
I can, Dr. Rock, and I'm ready to rock.
Very good. Well, thank you very, very much for agreeing to join us on the show. I've been very much looking forward to talking to you, and you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
So, it looks to me from your website and your various video interviews and your wide knowledge of the people involved in your field of extraterrestrial contact that a match must have started some time ago. When did you kick it off?
Well, I pronounce it a mash, just like mashed potatoes. And I know a lot of people find that a tricky one because it sounds a bit like the Irish word, which means out, I think. So maybe that's appropriate. But anyway, well, in fact, tomorrow, the 23rd of January, is the fourth anniversary of the initiation of MASH, which is just amazing because it's been through one or two changes. And, yeah, you know what? I really saw that there was nothing to address, the abductee concerns or even to give them voice or to, you know, help them and support them. And I think that those folks are at the coalface of experience. They are the ones who can possibly teach us some of the most important things we need to know about our next stage of evolution as a species, and that is to become cosmic citizens. And I know some people have the problem with the word citizens, but just bear with me. I can't think of another word to use at the moment. But anyway, fellow sovereign human beings, how about that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And like all pioneers, I guess they have a pretty tough time of it.
They do. They absolutely do. And although there are many who feel that this is a spiritual path, eventually, they often don't feel that at the time. In the initial stages, it's often, especially from adulthood, it's often very challenging, really super scary. I mean, I had a young man call me yesterday, and I do believe he has some mental health problems. So, but, you know, when I say that, it doesn't detract that what he has to say is real or not real. It doesn't mean that it's not real just because he has some issues. But he was really scared and said, you have to let people know, and I'm not going to say his name, that that I have been taken because I feel that I'm being taken. And I said, well, whatever, you know, makes you think that. And he's only, you know, a youngster, 19. And he said, he had a spiritual awakening recently. And I said, okay, well, what does that mean for you? What happened? And I think he did have a spiritual awakening, but often what happens, especially if you are not used to grounding yourself, and that, you know, that takes a bit of a simple bit of knowledge, but it's a specialism bit of knowledge of just anchoring yourself into your body and into your other levels of being so that you don't lose your axis mentally or health-wise, emotionally. And basically he said that he had an experience of feeling the oneness of everything, of the interconnectedness, and that he felt that he could communicate with nature, like people talk about who have had deep, profound spiritual experiences, and they see that there is just this web and we're all part of it, so we affect each other. Anyway, that can also kind of blast your energy field open and cause ruptures, if you like, or tears in the fabric of your being. And I sat in circle for quite a few years, and I'm a healer. And one of the things that I observed was that people can have shocks and traumas which cause tears or rips, for want of a better word, in your own particular discrete fabric, your own energy field. And if that is not dealt with, it's like a bleeding wound. You can attract infection. You know, if we left a wound open for long enough, it would go gangrenous. It would, you know, we'd have to lose it and all the rest of this at the extreme ends. It's actually very similar on an energy level, from my experience, is that if you don't deal with the hemorrhaging, you can have huge parasitic issues and events. And whether these are spirits of the departed or whatever you want to call those, or ETs or other beings that are attracted by your light, by your energy field, that remains open to discussion. So this person was absolutely frightened that they were going to be taken, and, you know, gave me their address. You said, you have to let them know, people know that, if I disappear, I've been taken by aliens. Now, you know, he sounded, you know, in a very challenging space, and I talked him down through his high emotion, and did some what I would call protection work from, you know, like a remote viewing side of things, but remote healing. And we know from science that that works very, very well. But he was also very impacted by voices he was hearing, so he was very scared that nothing that I could do or say would really work, although he was much calmer when we spoke, and I've left him to call me any time. If he needs an emergency call, he can call me, and to let me know how things are in the next 2-3 days.
I guess your experience must help quite a lot there, because, I mean, effectively, if you're only used to what we might call the normal workaday world, and then suddenly, and you're not a seeker or a searcher or have any training in meditation or anything, to suddenly become aware that everything is one and to feel that, to grok it through your being, must be, like, traumatic.
Absolutely, and you know, it will. It's like splitting the atom. It's you become split. So what you have to do after that is to just reassemble yourself. But if you don't know about that, if you don't understand, you know, if you're fully cognizant and you have maturity about you, and you don't have to be any age to have that. But if you know, you know, about grounding and about all of that stuff to keep you safe mentally and emotionally and of course physically, that's fine. But if it's brand new, it's like you're a starburst. You're like a fractured spirit. You're all over the place. And part of what I do in my healing and in, you know, just talking people through things is to help bring them back to a balance of perspective, so we can have a conversation about what they're, you know, going through, and I can at least hear them and help them to be as grounded as possible, so that you know, that they can get on with life to some degree, so they can have some balance.
I think it must help as well to keep people actually free, if you like, from not keep them from being locked up effectively, having somebody that can understand them, to talk to them, because there's a lot of people such individuals could go to, and they'd just be in a lot of trouble for even trying.
Oh yeah, no, that's right. I mean, quite a few people I've spoken to over the nearly 4 years with the MASH, you know, have thought about going to their doctors, going to the medical. One, in fact, one did. I still have an interview in the can, and I really must get my act together and get that out, of a gentleman who did indeed go down that route because he had nowhere else to go, and so he's, you know, gone down the medication route. And he's become dependent on it and still is on that. But he contacted me because he'd been having these incredible interactions. And his fear was so much. He was a Muslim, and he converted to Christianity. And then, you know, he was having a lot of issues. So he then joined a monastery down Crawley Way, which is West Sussex Way, for about 3 years in an attempt to anchor and get some peace and stability. But he was also abducted whilst he was at the monastery. And I went to the monastery, went on a field trip with him, went to talk to one of the fathers there also about, you know, what he thought about what was going on. And, you know, I think the people who come forward and speak to me, not only just speak to me on the phone, like privately, but then come on the shows or an interview with me, are incredibly brave. They are really breaking down the barriers. And, you know, we definitely should salute them, whatever you think, dear listener, of the subject or what they have to say, because it takes some chutzpah to do what they do.
I agree entirely. And I mean, the thing that struck me about the guests that you've had on your show are that they, you know, they do sound incredibly down to earth. They sound like the salt of the earth, like really good people.
They generally are, of course. I mean, they're people. They're just, well, you know what? Are they people? You know, when I say that, I mean, I think we were just talking prior to this hookup about the genesis of humanity. And I totally believe that, you know, in the intervention theory, that we are genetically, engineered. And so maybe we are not human as we would know it or think it, but you know, yeah. We've come to get used to who we are as this current level of development of our species of humanity. But in fact, there's quite a lot about the human system that is not normal. For example, we have something like, and I think I might have mentioned it with Andrew Johnson on the show when we were talking about the late, great Lloyd Pye, the Star Child Skull Project, about the fact that humanity has something like 4,000 issues in their genome, where most species will have a few hundred at the most, but we have about 4,000. And these are not imperfections. It's the wrong word. I'm struggling for the right word. But anyway, basically in our makeup, it looks like parts of us have been switched off and it looks like other parts have been engineered. And so it's not fully functioning. So some of the people who are, as Steve Colburn mentioned last night, the scientists, that there are upsides to the abduction scenario, and that is, he mentioned increased strength, because I related a story about that, and also higher IQ, higher sensitivity, higher awareness, and that's also tough to have in this world where it is so, you know, not only diverse, but there are so many people still well and truly under the hypnosis effect of the powers that be, or were, as some people like to say.
Certainly, and they don't like things that are different, do they?
No, not at all. But you know, I really do take my hat off to folks that speak about this, and especially people like, you know, who are professionally still working in their field, like scientists, like Steve Colburn. I think that took a hell of a lot of courage to come forward. And, you know, he said, well, who's going to hear me in the UK kind of thing? Unlikely it's going to get back to my colleagues. And that's probably true. But nevertheless, he's going on record. And he didn't do that before. He was incognito. And I can tell you that in Dr. Lear's patient list, he is there as patient John Smith, and it might be number 15, I think he said he was.
Yeah.
So, and it took a lot for him to even come this far forward.
And that is progress, isn't it? Because this is exactly what we need, is we need voices that are clearly credible to be speaking.
Absolutely, you know, and I'm very encouraged by the new American body group called FREE, which is the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters, because they are bringing on board physicists who are experiencers, and I'm going to be interviewing them one of them next month, which is going to be really exciting. He's a quantum physicist, I think. So I've got to do a bit of homework there. Yeah. And clinical psychologists, other professional people, as well as experiencers, people like Mary Rodwell and Ray Hernandez, who was on the first show. And they are really, and this was all, by the way, ET led. So it seems that ET is definitely now beginning to lead the field in what's getting out there.
This was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is that, it seems that, a lot of these ETs have aims and intentions that are at best obscure, and I was wondering whether there were any out there who are obviously trying to help.
Well, I definitely think there are. I think there's no two ways about that. There are the others. I think this place is such an amazing school, and has so many amazing opportunities, and atmosphere and flora and fauna and all of that. And we are, I think, a pretty amazing species, despite, you know, some of our failings or weaknesses. I think we are pretty astonishing, and our resilience is incredible.
And I think we could be much more astonishing if we were fully functioning, because as you've implied, there's only some 3% of our DNA currently active. And from what I've read as to what's called junk DNA, is that a good portion of it is stashed in one of the safest and most incorruptible parts of the code. So it does sound to me like it's awaiting to be activated rather than,
yeah,
you know, discarded. And if it has been discarded, it's maybe by the kind of modification that you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, I think that there's no discarding going on. I think there is a careful triggering process going on. And again, just to reflect back on Mike Smith, for example, he was the ex-soldier, musician, ex-soldier, who believed in nothing to do with this kind of subject, thought that it was the realm of nutters, as he said, and people who needed serious mental help. I mean, he honestly, truly believed that in his heart. So when his disabled brother, he wasn't mentally disabled, but physically disabled brother, tried to show him pictures of what he saw taking him when he was a child, he honestly thought that the disability had somehow traveled to the brain, and that he was now, you know, a lost cause. And even to his death, the brother died 6 months before Mike had what he called his download, which I've described as a near-death experience from what I've read about those. And it's the nearest thing I can equate to what Mike went through, to what we have in literature around. And his brother, right to the end, swore that he was actually part of them, and had perhaps was even instrumental in causing his brother's disability, which was pretty horrendous. A pretty horrendous thing to say and, you know, die leaving your brother with. But then again, at that time, Mike just thought, my God, this guy has just totally lost it. And then when he was triggered to wake up, he nearly lost his own mind. He really nearly did, because he was just coming back from a gig, musical gig across the Berwyn Mountains, the famous Berwyn Mountains, if anybody's heard of those. That's where there was an alleged UFO crash in, I think, something like February 1974.
And one of your podcasts has Russ Kellett talking about that in detail, if I remember
right. Oh, that's really interesting.
Great show.
Interesting. Anyway, so Mike had an encounter over there, lost 26 miles of the journey, and I did that journey with him, so we tested it. So I went and did a field trip with Mike and went to all the major places. Anyway, back to the download. He was just, you know, sitting down, not before he'd seen this gigantic 300-foot-tall cone kind of affair, and he just thought that it was a very clever laser show from Osiris Teon. I mean, that's how locked out he was.
Yeah.
Because he's not a silly guy. He, you know, and he said, I can't tell you why it was like that, Jen. All I can tell you is that after I had the download, it's like I knew everything. It's like I knew stuff. He said, I came to talking about atoms. I also knew the government knew all about this. He said, I was also, and this guy's had no education, really nearly no education. And he was seeing strange hieroglyphic imprints coming, like embossed, coming off the wall, as well as seeing the aliens through the TV. I mean, for goodness sake. And it sent him into a downward spin.
Well, once again, if you've really not encountered anything like that before, or even thought about it,
That's right.
All you can do, I'm not surprised he thought it was a laser show, because he's a lead guitarist, and he's a musician, so that's probably the closest thing he could come up with. And, you know, a couple of things struck me about Mike's story. One of them was how strange it must have been to be having all the experiences he was having in his life with no explanation right up to the age of 43, and then suddenly in a moment to understand them all. I mean, that must be extraordinary.
Well, that's what the near-death experience, I call it. Not that he was dying, but he was dying to an old self, let's call it that, to the old self that was. He was being released back into himself. He felt that he had been piggybacked, for want of a better term, for all these years by E.T.
Yeah.
Who'd been using him, he feels, as a guinea pig. And he's not the only one to talk about this either. A lot of people have this kind of feeling about what they've been through too, because in that near-death experience, I'll call it, he saw his entire life replayed before him, and he also saw all the abductions. So he saw all his life, including the abductions, his military ones as well.
Yeah, quite outrageous, really, because that's like having half of your life missing and then suddenly having it return. And unlike so many of the others, it just happened spontaneously to him, didn't it? He didn't need to go through the memory recovery routine.
No, he didn't. But what's interesting is that during that time, that would be like, let me think, 1993, and Mike was in Wales, and he tried desperately to find someone to talk to about this, and he was rebuffed roundly and soundly by a very prominent local Welsh researcher, whose name I won't give out. And then they began writing scurrilous, defamatory letters to the field, people in the field in the area, saying that he was a pot-smoking hippie and delusional and not to be, you know, trusted. And, you know, someone else went to them with their story, and they just didn't want to know. So these kind of researchers are only interested in a sighting, maybe a Berwyn Mountain thing or whatever, but they're not interested in the real human story because, you know what, I think it changes everything. Also, I think that some people and researchers, even in this field, are put here to manage how this material gets out and try and discredit it.
I think that's almost bound to be the case. As you say, that these people have got important things that we need to know, then they're, in my experience, after 3 or 4 years of doing this sort of stuff, I've realised that there are shills or infiltrators in nearly everything useful that's going on, and that their main job seems to me is not to absolutely kind of derail something, but to just knock it a bit off target.
That's right. It's like the half-truth thing. It's like a match. You know, I started out with Miles Johnston as a colleague. I brought him in because we were doing these interviews and he knew all about that side of things. So I thought, that's great. You know, so I organized everything, did the conferences and all the rest of that. But it wasn't long. Well, it was actually. It was about a good 18 months before I realized that something was quite wrong. And then I began to hear stories of harassment, of, all kinds of stuff, like stalking kind of behavior, all the rest of that, and a lot of stuff. And then when I decided to go ahead with the documentary, which aired in 2013, which was, you know, a hatchet job, there was some good from it. There was some good from it, I must say, but...
It raises your profile.
Well, you know, I really took a lot of hit. We had, you know, I did a lot of work with Marie Kayali, and I thought we were actually quite good buddies. And then the next thing I got was a tirade of abuse, such as you've never seen, and from another woman called Sasha Christie, who, again, I'd been very friendly with. And I have to say that in the documentary, everybody was autonomous in what they wanted to do with the production team. So, you know, when Marie said she wanted to do the lie detector test and the biology test, that was her business, and I had nothing to do with it. I just simply set the thing in motion. If people wanted to do it, they could be part of it. So, you know, I just did my bit and they did their bit. So anyway, I was roundly blamed and absolutely maligned for that. For her failure to perform on the test, whatever. Now, I think that test was flawed, but that doesn't matter. But the fact is that, you know, Amash took a great beating. So did I personally from these people. And Mr. Johnston then went on to put out, I mean, you have to laugh, actually, scurrilous videos about me being a reptilian.
I watched one earlier on today. I watched a half hour kind of session. Quite extraordinary. It was. I thought that really honestly doesn't quite sound like the Joanne I've been listening to.
Honestly. Well, you know, I had somebody call me recently and it's an ongoing issue that to do with ET and all kinds of missing time stuff. And they just asked me about that because whilst I have a disclaimer about Mr. Johnston on my website, I haven't done videos and all the rest of stuff that he's done. I think he just got his nose put out of joint because I would not allow him to continue to do what he was doing. And that's why I had to disassociate myself pretty quickly. And unfortunately, we were well into doing the production when I knew that it wouldn't be long before. As soon as that was done, then I would, you know, Amash and Mr. Johnston would be no more. I was taking back the reins completely. But, you know, he did all kinds of tricks and all kinds of unpleasantnesses and still continues to. But that's, you know what, that's their game. You know, as far as I'm concerned, they're the ones that are going to, you know, reap the karma in the end. And I'm just getting on with everything. And so with the others who who someone said to me or reported to me recently that they thought I was being paid by some government body. I thought, oh yeah, that would be nice. Have you seen my pay packet?
Yeah.
Listen, I tell you what, if anybody approached me, I'd be the first to shout about it, because there's one thing that I definitely wouldn't tolerate, and that is being compromised by anything. You know, if I get things wrong, I'll get things wrong, and that's just me getting things wrong. But as far as malicious, intentional disinformation, working with the trolls and the shills, no, I've been at the sharp end of, having that, experiencing that. But, that's not a way to go. You know, we've got to get grown up about this. So that's why it's really important that a MASH remains a stable functioning unit in whatever format it takes. You know, now I'm doing the radio show since October, which is really nice. Not sure how long I'll be able to maintain the stress levels and getting that out there.
It does get easier, honest.
Yeah, at the moment, it's like giving me a heart attack.
I remember that. It was like that for me for some several months, I must admit. It still is occasionally, but it does get easier. It does. Especially
well,
with
I do take some courage from that then.
And you have got, apparently, you've certainly got a fair few. I've just heard you mentioning a fair few guests that you're going to have coming up. So you've clearly got plenty of people to talk to, which is the main thing, really.
Oh yeah. Oh, you know what? It's just amazing, this field. And I am absolutely, in awe of it, because it's just huge. And you know what? Humanity could really experience a change in our lifetime. I can't quite visualize how that might happen, how that might be engineered, but seems that something is brewing. Everybody I'm speaking to, especially these sensitives, these others, are talking about this. And nobody has specific details, but it is just like a building crescendo of sensing. So, and it feels like it's a shortish time frame, you know, like within a year, within 18 months. So who knows what that is, but I'm jolly sure it's going to involve our intergalactic cousins and our, you know, the Anunnaki lot. I don't know about where they are in the scheme of things. Mm.
No, indeed, it's definitely rumoured that they'll be, well, actually, that they're already back, as far as I can gather.
Well, there's so much stuff going on. It is really hard to be discerning here. But there's, as I said, there's the good and the good, the bad and the ugly in all of this. And it's no different from just life. But I think that we have been so compromised, our energy is so compromised by not only governmental powers, those that would, keep us dumbed down and stupid and keep us energy dependent, as well as the ETs. So we, poor old humanity, I can kind of ear bash humanity because I'm one of them too sometimes. But, really, when I think how hard we have it, God, it's no wonder we're, a bit daft around the edges, a bit slow on the uptake, because when we're not working with our full complement of abilities. And also, we've got chemtrails. They're kind of trying to poison us. We've got stuff like Monsanto. I mean, for God's sake, although, Monsanto is getting a kick in the pants now and again, which is yay, great. But so there's so many things that are causing, our not only our mental but also physical structure to be compromised, that it is tough, and it's enough for all of us just to, pay our way, pay our bills and keep a sane head if we can, at least as some kind of sense of, cohesion together. And that's quite hard. I find it hard sometimes.
I think, looking around me, I think that everybody in almost whatever situation they find themselves is experiencing their version of extreme challenge. I don't think it really matters whether you've got no money or shed loads of money, apparently.
Yeah.
We are, as it were, expressions of the moment, and the moment is frenetic.
It certainly is. My goodness. It's absolutely amazing. I don't see kind of the end point in where this sort of, as I was mentioning before, this sort of seems to be consensus of rising anticipation of a something about to happen, like a drawing to a conclusion of something. I don't know about that, but it just feels like with, for example, just going back to Free, that body, rising. And I think that's going to be an amazing thing because they are looking at things from a scientific point of view. And they've got some really big names involved. And it's quite, you know, I think, wow, for the first time, we've got scientists and physicists who are experiencers who are going to talk about that. They're going to go public. I mean, I tried to get a scientist into my conference last year. And they had analyzed a soil sample from an area where a UFO had discharged some matter. And so they'd done this paper. And I'd still love to maybe have him on. Maybe I'll speak to him. Maybe he'll speak to me again. Mm-hmm. because I took him to task slightly because he said he wasn't, didn't want to be tainted by the subject matter and by those associated, you know, by the UFO field, if you like, mm-hmm. as being, a scientist, you know, important scientist. Anyway. So there we go. A lot of people are afraid to be associated with the subject. And it does take a little bit of courage to,
tends to be that once one or two people, excuse me a moment, once one or two people step up to the plate, several more might follow. And like I say, people are so cynical and dubious about the idea of ETs or whatever we want to call them. I mean, there's loads of different names for them, but it seems to me, I know obviously everybody's got their own beliefs. That's what we're all, that's why there's 7,000 million people here. It's because there's that many things to believe. And if any of these scientists can turn out the kind of quality of story that Mike Smith did, then we're going to be in, as you put it, for a very interesting ride, because one of the things that struck me about Mike's story is that even though, you know, not many people have actually got physical bits of a spacecraft to show, possibly because they're not many of them physical craft, but the kind of, Mike's living in the real world with his wife or partner or whatever, and he's got a dentist and he's got people he works for, and the weird shit that was happening to Mike was one way or the other washing into other areas of his life. So like you say, the business of his younger brother actually seeing him being abducted when he wasn't aware himself that it was happening. And I thought one of the best bits was when he was talking about going to the dentist, and the dentist looked in his mouth and said, "Where did you have this work done?" And he hadn't had any work done as far as he was aware. That means there is a kind of there is a kind of backwash into the reality of other people. And I suspect that the more we get to hear from these people, the more rather than the less credible the idea will become, hopefully. Mind you, there's enough people out there who think that, that those two buildings were knocked down by a pair of aeroplanes. So they're clearly capable of believing most things.
Don't start me on that. Just don't get me started on that.
No, I was thinking about talking about that, but you did a very good job on that subject with another of your guests just before Christmas on the subject of the buildings and the
I feel quite passionately about that subject and about Dr. Judy Wood. I think her work is fantastic. There is none other like it. And, you know, the 9/11 scenario has been filled with shills and trolls and disinformants left, right and centre trying to muddy the waters. But, you know, she's gone with the evidence. And the reason that I really set my cap at interviewing her, because it was a great privilege. And also, here was the person who has the qualifications and the expertise to understand the very fine detail of what was going on. And to express that in a format that was understandable to me and others. And she went out on a limb, big style. You know, she got together a court case with the New York Supreme Court. And yes, it was finally thrown out. But you know what? I bet it could go in again because every argument was valid, and the fact that she wouldn't be heard is another matter.
Well, the court had to basically disobey its own rules in order to be able to do that to her, didn't it? Which I guess comes as no surprise, really.
That's right. They'll just bend everything, you know, until they get the verdict they want. But no, I mean, what an incredible woman to go ahead, you know, because this all goes into energy. This is a lot of this subterfuge is about keeping the energy stuff quiet. Now, there must be hundreds of thousands of people out there who are, you know, garage scientists and inventors who are doing a fabulous job. And people like John Searle, whom I know, who's now up in San Diego, an English guy who for 40, 50 odd years, you know, has been developing the SEG, which can also clean radiation fallout. And I know that Steve was also going to be working with John Hutchinson, the wonderfully maverick Canadian scientist, self-taught, who is also going to be working on some kind of Fukushima, you know, neutralization energy kind of device. You know, this is really exciting stuff. There's lots of fabulous stuff going on here. And, you know, what a service these people are doing for humanity. What an incredible service for free.
Yes. Yeah, which is the way we need it to be. And there's a part of me that believes that the these sort of solutions and this sort of energy and commitment and dedication is arising directly out of the seriousness of the situation that we find ourselves facing, and that more and more people are going to be driven to coming up with that kind of solution. And I'm sure it can be sorted out one way or the other.
Well, you know, John Hutchinson, I don't know if many people know about him, but anyway, he's be a great one to Google. Go and check him out. But he went with his partner with 600 pounds in weight of equipment to the BP oil disaster area off his own bat, because he just couldn't stand the fact that the governing bodies around there had got loads of offers in. Even Kevin Costner has a company that deals with cleaning oceans and stuff like that. You know, he'd gone ahead and offered his services. Loads, I think it went into the thousands, if not many, many hundreds. I can't remember the details now at this juncture. But anyway, so John Hutchinson went out there and spent days, and you can see this on YouTube. I think they put up like a log. And what he did was used the sonic waves to break up the oil, because so many creatures were in such terrible distress, you know, and the sea, of course, is a living creature as well, and that was in such distress. And, you know, this guy went there off his own back. I think, you know, and who knows about this kind of heroic stuff that people are doing. It's wonderful. I'm just really, you know, impressed by some of the effort that humanity makes in you know, seemingly small ways. But he did a great job, and okay. and you know, really helped.
Yeah, and it is amazing what one individual can do. And again, one tends to lead to more.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I was quite thrilled to hear that the scientist I had on last night, Steve Colburn, is going to be working with John. So that's going to bring forth some amazing stuff, because it's all to do, you know, with that scalar technology stuff, and, you know, following on from the Tesla kind of stuff, using the ambient energy of the atmosphere, that kind of thing. It's all really exciting, and it absolutely, every single bit, all is part of the ET area. I focus down and drill down to work with people in their emotional, mental, spiritual selves, and I'm very interested in people's wellness. I've been a researcher in health and wellness for a long time, and I'm a therapist, so, you know, it's of great interest to me how people do when they're having these experiences, and to try and create strategies and things to help support people.
Is that what got you into forming a MASH? Because you're not an experiencer yourself, are you?
No, I'm not. No, not that I'm aware of anyway. No, I'm not. No, it was just that there was nothing in the UK that remotely dealt with this. You know, there's quite a lot going on in the States, and I think there are some support groups in the UK, but these, you know, tend to be local, and quite private, you know, not necessarily big public things. And so it's difficult for people to get to hear about it. So I really felt that we needed a focal point to, you know, put people in touch with one another, that kind of thing, which I'm always careful about doing if I do that. And hopefully to stimulate the interest to, I think, as I said last night, to start their own groups. And if people need support from a MASH, i.e., you know, some idea about how to structure a meeting or something like that, you know, that I would be there to offer support, like the Dorset Amash support group do. That, you know, they came to see me and we had a meeting, because if it's going to have the Amash name attached, I just want to know that they, you know, are following certain protocols, and that is just of good practice, well, you know, sympathetic, empathetic openness to people. And one of their party is an experiencer anyway, so I didn't have to worry too much about them. And they're just great people. They're activists as well, talking about, you know, the chemtrails and fracking and all the stuff that is going on that's hurting the earth and hurting our environment. So, you know, no, there's nobody who's an experiencer generally who is just an experiencer. They tend to also have other areas of interest. And, you know, after the documentary, I really thought I would, you know, because it made me cringe. I just hated it. But I had 300 emails of support and people saying, well, thank you for being a voice out there. Thank you for being the one to put your head above the parapet. After the bruising had gone down, I felt better.
Yeah, I guess some people must see through the edit, as it were.
They did. You know, I had a call from a guy and his wife, who they've become great friends, who said, I guess that wasn't how you wanted that to go. You know, thank God for intelligent observation, because of course not. Why would I put a mash forward to be, you know, killed? No, of course not. But you know, having said all that, it opened it up in the UK for people, and people realized there was somewhere they could come, and they did realize, you know, that Channel 4 were just, you know, adding to the disinfo thing, and they'd got their own agenda clearly. But I'd had one or two calls from activists, people who just wanted someone else to talk to, and also mind control people, people who had experienced voice to skull, people who had experienced targeted individuals. They're called TIs now, they've become known as. So I had one or two calls from targeted individuals who were activists who were experiencing, you know, microwave attack. Stuff like this, awful thing. Things like Samantha McDonald mentioned, actually. She began to experience her body heating up from the inside out. And some of the activists said, you know, I'm not an experiencer. I'm not a UFO guy, but I can tell you that I've been experiencing some pretty, you know, pretty unpleasant stuff because, you know, I reckon of being an activist. And these are people speaking out about chemtrails, writing to their MPs, actually doing stuff about it, and all manner of other kind of grassroots activism. It's the people at the, you know, at the grassroots that are making the difference, and those are being targeted. So I thought that was very interesting, because there are more people being targeted than we realize, and it seems to be that the government and all those involved with these nefarious operations can very easily these days target an individual, like just get on hold of a, you know, their frequency signal and tap into them and just, you know, debilitate them. There's an amazing book called Satellite Terrorism. I think it's called Satellite Terrorism in the US by John Hall, Dr. John Hall. He's an anaesthetist, and he got on the wrong side of his boss, who had a private practice out in Texas a few years ago. And he did nothing more to incur this guy's wrath than, you know, maybe make a comment that he thought that he was treating his wife rather badly by cheating on her. And anyway, whatever that thing was, you can read about that if you want to in John's book. But I was astonished, because this guy began to experience, he wasn't an ET guy, but this is just going on to the TI stuff and how easy it is for people to buy maybe downtime, satellite downtime. And if you've got enough money, you can borrow that satellite transmitter for a bit and you can focus it on somebody. And you can do all kinds of things to disrupt them. I mean, this guy was coming back and finding, you know, they knew where he was at any time of the night or day. So his home was constantly broken into. I mean, they were trying to kill him in the end. That's amazing. And this was definitely, you know, using surveillance techniques like satellite, because there would be no other way. And, you know, you've got an anaesthetist. Now, this is a, you know, guy who's nobody's fool. And he suffered horrendously, and so did his partner, whom ended up having horrendous things happen to her, which I won't go into. But, that's a whole nother subject. That is another spin-off from all of this, tactics intimidation.
I did eventually look into mind control. It wasn't something that, because I try to steer clear of things that are going to drop my resonance, as it were. But
I understand.
I remember reading that. Well, every now and then you have to, don't you? I remember reading that it was possible for to actually project a voice into somebody's head that just wouldn't be heard by the people either side of them. I've got no idea. Right. Angel in the chat box has asked, how do they do that? Tap into somebody's frequency.
There's actually, I don't know if it's in America or Japan, and you can look this up yourself, you can Google it, and it's actually being used in advertising. And what they've got, they did a test, I don't know if it's still running, but where people would, say, walk past a billboard, say at street level, and it would activate by the person, and it would talk to them. I mean, this would be voice to skull.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, go and check some of that out, folks. They can easily do it. You know, they can do it through your wiring also, your BT wiring and stuff like that. They can tap into all of that. It's, you know, honestly, for example, just going back to Mike Smith, this is, on one occasion, he found some wires coming out of his wall. And when he went to pull them, they kind of receded. And I know this is absolutely bananas. And he was having massive problems with his phone. So he finally got BT in, and he was having all kinds of issues, like as if he was hearing things and there was interruption on the calls. And he believed that he was being surveilled. And he said to the BT guy, because the BT guy said to him, "This looks like a party line." And Mike said, "Well, I think it's the NSA. And you know what? That guy ran out.
Right.
He said, "Oh, that's nothing I can deal with."
Yeah.
Now, he actually said, "That's nothing I can deal with."
And he said, "It looks like a party line." I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, this stuff happens, and it's not very difficult to get a fingerprint of your own frequency and resonance, you know, of your own particular discrete resonance, and to program it. You know, these days it's very easy. There's Anne Andrews' son, Jason, when Anne Andrews was talking about the implants that they found, she said, "Well, what the heck are they for then? Is it for tracking?" And, you know, Jason just said, "No, they don't need to track you. They've got your vibration, their frequency. If they want you, they just, you know, pinpoint you by your frequency. No, they're more monitoring for health or for other things." But also, I think that there are implants done by people like governmental bodies and other such nefarious agencies who want to know what's going on. And they too are kind of leaping on the bandwagon, and I think have been doing for a long time, because there's many, many stories of not only during an alien abduction where people have seen not only ET, but also human beings that are not hybrid, as far as they could tell, and also military personnel with guns, with, you know, in full, you know, camouflage gear, all of that kind of stuff.
Yes, the military do seem to be deeply involved in all of this. And I guess these kind of technologies you're talking about, I'm pretty much aware that once I read about something in a book, it's already probably 50 years out of date, and I won't read about what's going on now until 2065 or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I one time went to meet up with a guy called Tim Rifat, who's a scientist guy. I think he's a chemist. I lose track of him. Anyway, he was in Brighton. I went to meet him in Brighton, and he had the whole of his dash leaded out. And he said, "Right, we'll go somewhere," because I wanted him as a speaker for my conference that I was thinking about putting on. It didn't come to anything at that time. But anyway, and I said, "Well, why have you got that?" And he said, "Well, if they want to put anything in your car, they'll do it at the level where you're driving, because that's directly at the heart level and they can induce a heart attack very easy." He said the lead shielding will stop that, deflect that. And what he would do would be to go around Brighton and wherever with it would measure microwaves. And what he observed was the Brighton police hitting vagrants, tramps, undesirables with certain wavelengths, which would make people feel sick, so ill that they just had to move on. And he would go up and knock on the door of the police van. Unfortunately, he got, you know, arrested a few times and had his equipment confiscated. And now I believe you can't even buy the kind of kit that he once had with that degree of sensitivity. You know, and he said his flat was just irradiated with it. So, you know what? And I know you said, you know, you don't want to look at things that take your resonance down. And no, it is difficult. But, you know, to be a little bit informed, I think it's a positive thing, because, you know what you're dealing with as well. And also you can just, join that party of people who decide to be sovereign and carry on with your life in as positive a way possible, which is not always easy every single day, every moment. It's not, and mine's not, but, you do your level best. Because
yeah, I think it kind of goes with the territory, really.
It does.
I guess it does. It's more, with me, it's more a matter of once I endured my original shocks on some of the things like paedophilia and mind control and super soldiers and stuff, it became more a matter of, I guess it's a matter of choosing what order it is that I choose to look into things.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Listen, sometimes it's too much. You have to switch off, go walk in the woods. I mean, that's, people said to me, how do you maintain your sanity? How do you deal with some of, because some of it's quite dark. And just because it's dark doesn't mean if someone is suffering because they've had some interference or some, been impacted by something that, say, is sexual in nature or, focused on the sexual organs, of course you deal with that. But it is tough to know that certain people are having a horrendous time with interactions and, we don't know the bigger picture, so we're just dealing with the microscopic at the moment. But, those folks need support. They need a safe space in which to express what they feel is happening. And, it's very hard to talk about that stuff. It's very hard to open up to anybody, a stranger, myself as well. And the times that people have said to me, if I had a pound for every time someone said, you'll think I'm crazy, I'd be doing quite well. I'd be able to afford a little holiday at least.
Yeah, you don't get much time for those doing this, I'm afraid.
There's certainly no money for holidays in this, I'll tell you.
No, indeed. No, that's another thing, isn't it? With so many of us are doing things for just for the love of it, really.
Just some fresh air. Well, I just think it's important. I think it's really important that this field is, people are made aware of it. However they want to deal with it or choose to accept it or interpret it, that's up to them. But I tell you, I mean, it's like Steve was saying last night, there is a mountain of evidence. There really, really is, from the Lloyd Pye's Star Child skull to the hair of the alien to crash debris. I mean, honestly, it's an enormous field with enormous evidence.
Yeah, I've got Brian Forster lined up for a couple of weeks from now.
Oh, great!
Because we chatted with him a couple of years ago about the elongated skulls he's got in his museum, which have only got two plates. They've only got a front plate and a back plate. They don't have the two parietal plates like humans do. And basically, he was refusing to be drawn on the subject because I said, we're defined by our bones, by our physiology. If it hasn't got the same kind of skull as we've got, surely it's not human. And he was waiting for DNA results, which I think were being done by the same laboratory that was working with Lloyd.
Because he and Lloyd sort of hooked up.
Yeah.
Because, Lloyd said that he would have been working with the Coneheads if he hadn't, as they're called often, if he hadn't got the Star Child, because that was, like the next thing. But, I mean, it's like those guys, those Conehead folks, I mean, they've got more than double our brain space.
Yes.
And that would be filled with brain. It wouldn't be just air.
No, I think that one of the skulls that Brian has in his museum still shows imprint of the brain right the way up at the top of the skull. And they've also got, I gather, a couple of holes at the back and the base of the skull, which nobody knows what they're for, but we don't have them.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think you're right. And I think it's like everything else, you can kind of swan through life, believe in everything to be all right. And I'm daily meeting people who do not realize that anything is wrong at all.
I know. How amazing is that?
But indeed. But then suddenly it's like, when you notice a little snag on your pullover and you decide to give it a tug and suddenly the whole thing starts coming apart around your ears. It's not like you kind of, and I think the other thing is that certainly with me, for years, there were kind of little clues. There were things happening which were telling me, this situation is really very, very undesirable. And I just kind of had a slide response. I just looked away and carried on. But when you get to the point where you actually engage consciously with what's going on and start taking some sort of responsibility for it, then all those other experiences come back to the fore. And it's it's almost like you're kind of progressing intuitively for quite a while, but none of that work is wasted. So even people who appear to be completely, misinformed are in fact, I'm sure, taking on bits of information which will later be useful to them, which is one of the reasons why I think we should continue to do the work we're doing.
Yeah. Yes. No, I agree to some extent, because sometimes it seems that there are some real rockheads around, let alone coneheads. And you think, how could they possibly, you know, be where they are and see what's going on around them and not think that something is out of whack?
Yeah. Anyway. Well, I think, of course, the great disappearance of buildings in New York was a really good example to bring that to our attention. It must have taken even more effort and money and manpower to cover it up than it did to actually pull it off in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I think it was perhaps a long time in, you know, in the planning, and it was they thought it was well executed, but they just didn't realize that, you know, a few people around the table had, you know, already developed to some degree in their discernment. And then you have people like Dr. Judy Wood who went, excuse me, that can't possibly be how that happened. I mean, that just can't happen.
But, you know, if you feel that you've got a lot to lose, then sometimes it's safer to believe what you're being told, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And listen, you know, you were asking me beforehand about some of the people who've lost their lives to this field of research.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty dangerous place to be working to me.
Yeah. And or if you happen to be in, you know, in the 1980s in Marconi, you know, they lost about, I can't remember, it's 25, 27 people to mysterious deaths and suicides over a very, very short period. And they were the go-to company at the time for exotic weaponry. And as Hillary Porter said, and explained, she was an engineer's draftsperson at the time in Marconi when there was a break-in. And the security man.
That was a great story. Carry on. I like that one.
Oh, it's just, I mean, you know, when I heard that, I thought, what? Really? Really? No. And then, you know, I know Hillary, and she's a bright lady. And basically what she found out was the night watchman had stumbled across ET rifling through some top secret stuff in their top secret section. Why they would need to do that, I don't know. That doesn't quite work for me, but nevertheless.
Perhaps they just wanted to be seen in there doing it.
maybe that was it, because that night watchman was whisked off, never to be seen again.
I shouldn't think it did anything for his sense of security.
Very good.
We've got some questions popping up in the chat box. If you're happy to have a look at some of those.
Yeah,
they're always a bit random, but the first one, I can't remember, it was a while back. I think it came from Lee. And it's, can you ask the guest, what is your opinion concerning the Betty and Barney Hill star map?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because I can't remember if it wasn't, I'm just trying to remember now the details of that, because it was some lady, it took quite a long time for someone to look at it and realize that they may be able to actually map it, which they did. And it was only when they did, because it wasn't really taken seriously before, but it was only when they got a 3D image going that they understood that this was something real. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, say, was it real? Or whatever, but you know, for someone whose field it is to then make up a model of that and then to find it based in fact, that's pretty amazing.
So what was this star map? I remember reading
about
it.
What it about... was is that, to be honest, I would have to go back and look it up myself. You know, I've looked at so much stuff over the years that some of the details gone back into the recess of my memory, but basically Betty was shown this map of where they came. They kind of showed her a map. And she didn't know where that was. She just kind of drew it out. I don't mean in any kind of detailed way, but she drew what she saw. And then I might have even been some years later. It was modeled. It was 3D modeled, as far as I remember. And you can see, if you Google the modeling of the Betty and Barney Hill star map, you'll see that. And I think that brought out some awareness of where those guys were from. And that was amazing. And I can't remember what it's called. I'm really sorry, folks. I'm a bit vague on that. But, you know, I think that was real. Yeah. It's like, you know, Stan Romanek. He's a guy, and a lot of people are dyslexic, folks. This is really interesting. Mike's dyslexic, apart from the fact he's had zero education, which is very interesting because he's a very bright man. But Stan Romanek was dyslexic, and he, you know, would, under hypnosis, would draw out all these incredible equations, which scientists have had a look at. And I don't know what the outcome of all those things is, but it's based on in reality. And Stan doesn't know the first thing about science or maths.
Again, it seems to me that somebody somewhere, whatever they are, is definitely trying to prove to us that something's going on.
That's right. There's some kind of stimulation of awakening of, you know, it's like Mike came to talking about atoms and he didn't even know what an atom really was. I mean, you know, he'd heard about it, but he didn't really know how it operated and what its functioning was and how the structure of it as part of a world. But, you know, it set him on a course of hunger, of learning. It really did. And even today, we're just finishing off writing this book. It's been going on and on because of technical issues and stuff. But what he said was that even today, he feels compelled to look at the news, which often depresses him. I said, yeah. Well, don't look. He said, I have to. He said, it's like I'm waiting to see something. He said, I don't know whether it's going to be like confirmation, but it's as if I have to do it to wait for that something to come through on a news item. He said, I don't know what that is either. Interesting.
Or I guess what effect it's going to have given the, because these significant changes in your thought processes are recognized in other connections, aren't they? I remember reading psychological reports on people who wake up speaking a language that they've never learnt, and people who, like I read about an American lady who suddenly, I think she had a small stroke or something, and she ended up sounding like an American imitating an English person, which is apparently the best way to make yourself totally unpopular in America. So people's brains can completely change, you know, and yeah. That's to suddenly have a language that you never had before is amazing.
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot going on with kind of the rewiring of people, and you know, I'm not in that club. I'm not in that club, but I'm observing it at very close quarters, and you know, I'm ever looking to find that nugget of something that's going to be like the linchpin for another phase of understanding and discernment about the whole stuff that's interacting with us.
Yes, and that might come as a moment of realization, because this business is suddenly realizing that everything is one. I've read a couple of books written by people who've had that experience, and they're beautiful. One of them is a book called As It Is by Tony Parsons.
Right.
And the other one was by David Kass, and I can't remember its name at the moment, but they basically write really beautifully about this. So, and they think it's an opportunity. It's a potential for everybody and anybody. And can you imagine how different the world would be if suddenly everybody woke up, or the majority of people, or even a critical mass woke up realizing that they are one with everything?
Yeah. I mean, I'd really like to experience that myself. I really would. I haven't. I understand the principle of it. I get it. Mm. And I, you know, do my fair share of communicating with trees and nature. Mm-hmm. and that's great. And I feel a connection. But as to that sort of on a mental level, you know, like a really embedded feeling level as well, I would love to.
Yeah. To have that. If nothing else, it stands in direct opposition to the evident aims of the world management team, which is to separate things as much as possible and to hit analysis everywhere, where synthesis would be perhaps more desirable.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. No, quite agree with you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I remember the Brian Kass books just popped into my brain. It was called Perfect Brilliant Stillness.
Oh, that's lovely.
It is. It's well worth a read. He was kind of forced into writing the book by people who said, you've got to write about it. And he refers to himself throughout as that David thing.
Yeah, well, it's funny because Mike has a kind of similar relationship to his old self. He just doesn't recognize him.
Wow.
I mean, even the Rosemary West incident, I mean, that was, he's had the most bizarre association with the Wests, which is weird beyond weird. And he was just at that time not awake. Mm. And maybe it saved his life.
Yeah.
Maybe it did.
Yeah. Another question from the chat box. We have Rick asking whether you've done journey therapy.
I haven't done journey therapy specifically, but my own work is very much like journey therapy. In fact, my own therapy really works at clearing patterns that are no longer helpful that get locked into certain parts of the body, the mind, the whole body, mind, psyche area, and can get extended out into the energy fields. So that can take you on a real journey, or you can start with a journey. But I haven't done the journey, but my mind sort of encompasses a lot of, I've broadened it out as well over the years. But yeah, thanks, Rick. I suspect that it's very, you know, there are many layers of crossover.
Yeah. So do you use hypnosis or meditation?
No, it's guided visualization. It's just very simple. It is guided visualization. And so that is, so the person is completely conscious, never, they don't even have to close their eyes. I mean, I worked with one young lady about 18 months ago now, who was nothing to do with ET, but a mind control victim. And I didn't know whether my work would work. I didn't know whether it would touch it or not. But in fact, it did. It was amazing. But she was so terrified of the process and fearful of me, of everything, because she had been so traumatized by what she'd been through, that she would not close her eyes. She didn't have to. But I've never worked with anybody who kept their eyes open. But the work was just as effective with her eyes open. And we got her eating and drinking and sleeping again, which was a major issue. So that was great.
Yeah, I guess from the fact that that Amash's initials, the initials are for anomalous mind control, suggests in itself how central this appears to be to the whole experience. And certainly, most of your guests appear to have fallen victim to this. Presumably, given that they're just normal individuals, is it the? Do you think it's the ETs doing this to them? I know maybe it's sometimes the military, but
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Just back to Mike again, because I just know his case so well, but we can talk about many others. He didn't even know till he was 43. And why 43? Why that time of his life was important? We don't know yet about that. But yes, of course, absolutely perception managed. Absolutely.
And is this always the case, or do we yes. have some? It is always. So we don't have any experiencers who...
Yeah, you do get contactees. Let's just sort of tease out some of the differences. A contactee tends to be somebody who has conscious interaction, which doesn't tend to be a traumatizing event, because, you know, when it's a cooperative thing, when it's a co-created thing, event, you know, there is some kind of collusion in terms of friendly association. For example, this is something I came across yesterday. Somebody put me aware of it. Sorry. In 1995, I think it was, there was a couple back in, where were they? They were in one of the South Americas. I've just forgotten the country for the minute. And this couple with their family were on a beach having some time out. And then the wife and the kids went back to the car waiting for dad to pick up the rest of the bits and bobs that they'd got on the beach. When he saw a craft was there, and then he saw these three beings, and basically the upshot of what they asked him, if he thought that he and his wife would help them, could do them a favor, is how he, said it. And the favor was whether she would allow her body to be used as an incubator, because their race was dying and they were having a hard time reproducing, and it would be invaluable to them if they would agree. So he said, well, I don't know. She's not going to go sleeping with anybody. You know, she's not going to do that. He said, no, there would not be sexual contact. It would be done professionally and, all the rest of it. So he went and had a chat with his wife about this. He sort of was very careful how he broached the subject, and eventually she agreed to it. And then they went back and had a meeting with these folks and they inseminated her. And I think it was about 3.5-4 months later, they took the child and said that they would be in touch and let them know how all was going. So now that's very unusual, that there is a collaborative thing going on like that. Often, like Hillary mentioned, when she was in hospital, and I forget the issue she was in hospital for, but after, on a way to the loo, she saw a cupboard door that was open with jar upon jar of weird looking fetuses. And they weren't human, and they weren't just abnormal babies. They were different. And also, you know, someone else told me of a story that they got to their wife, who had just delivered, not long previously delivered, a baby. But when he arrived, she was all upset and saying that it was a stillbirth. And she said, also, they'd taken it away. This person wanted to see his child. But she said, no, it's best that you don't see it. And she described it. And when she described it, it sounded like an alien, like a grey alien. And then, to add to that mix, she then told her husband that someone from Oxford University had come up to take the body. So that is very weird, because you wouldn't get that if that was just an ordinary child.
And that was the lady who was working for Marconi.
No. Sorry. That story was different. No, the lady from Marconi saw these jars.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
And that story of, it was just somebody who's told me what happened to them and their wife, and they were very upset that they didn't get to see the body of their child, because at least they wanted some closure seeing the body. It was one thing for his wife to have given birth by herself and he'd hoped to be there, and then her upset at having given birth to what she thought was a disabled child. But, they just thought, well, that's the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah. Just sort of off the wall question. Obviously there's plenty of people who, no matter what they listen to, it seems to me, are not willing to take this idea on board.
Yeah, that's true.
What do you think where would you send someone? Where do you think the most convincing stuff is for people to start looking into the ET or non-terrestrial presence on Earth?
Well, I think, you know, a very good, although I don't go with a lot of what Dr. Greer says, and perhaps how he's done things recently, his disclosure project was excellent, and that's a great stepping stone for many people. The disclosure project was put out at the press club in, I think it was in New York, in 2001 in May. So interesting, isn't it, that it was in May of 2001, and then in September you've got 9/11. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Greer had been in touch with a lot of scientific, military, and different kinds of personnel, Air Force personnel, and got them to give their testimony, which they did. And it's all kinds of things. So from radar tracking of objects. And also, you know, you've got stories like that of Thomas Mantell, who died in, was it 48? I think he died in early 48. Now, Roswell, going back to the Roswell story, was 47. I think I might have got a year out. Anyway, it was the 1940s. And he and two other jets were scrambled to intercept a huge object, unknown object. And the other two, it got to such a height that in those days the jets couldn't go that far without losing oxygen. You know, that was a big issue. However, Thomas Mantell said, no, you can actually hear and listen, hear and read the transcript of the last transmission that he gave before he hit the ground. Basically, he said, no, I'm going to, he was up about, 30 odd thousand feet or more. And he said, no, I'm going in. I've got it in my sights any minute sort of thing. And the thing is about what we've been doing, we've been going into attack all the time. And it's clear that if any of our craft get too near the field of these other craft, that it causes a disassociation of the atoms and molecules of the structure, and the structure begins to fall apart. And we know that instruments stop working and that kind of thing. And so Mantell's craft hit the ground. He died chasing a UFO. And then we've got the report in the released UK files of Milton Torres, who was a US airman based over in the UK, who was sent up in 1957 with an order to shoot down a craft. and it wasn't one of ours, obviously, and it wasn't one of anybody else's of human origin that anybody knows. So, you know, this stuff is just out there. There's just loads of evidence. You know, you can go and listen to people like David Adair, who is a rocketry savant kid, and how one of the paperclip Nazis took him out to look at a craft, or the engine of a craft, which he had already made a smaller version of, but he then decided that he was going to sabotage his own craft, his own engine, which he did, so that those Nazi scientists wouldn't have the use of it, because he would have taken us to a next level, next generation of being out in space. Mm. But because of what humanity was doing, i.e. weaponizing it once again, he knew that he couldn't do it. The same with Wilbert B. Smith, the Canadian radio superintendent and engineer who worked with a very high level, the Americans in the 1950s and the 1940s and 50s, with crash debris and what have you, and frequencies. He also had, he was shown stuff by E.T., and he was also an inventor himself, and he basically deconstructed something that he'd made to do with free energy technology, and he just said humanity's not ready.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Yeah, yes. Somebody, a bunch that are as apparently irresponsible as our leading team seem to be, I guess it's not a good idea to risk something like that falling into their hands.
Yeah. So in answer, you know, short answer to that first question, that initial question was to go and have a look at the Disclosure Project, the 2001, listen to those people. And if you think that they're all lying and they're all whatever, well, you know, there's going to be no convincing you. And then if you go and listen to people like Robert O. Dean, who talks about being in the headquarters, SHAPE headquarters in France, and where he was given sight of one of only 15 copies of a document called The Assessment, which was created in the 1960s by one or two parties because of an incident that happened. And this incident was that a whole fleet of craft that were not of this earth was seen coming over from the Russian side over the American and UK and whatever airspace. And there were real fingers on the buttons. They really thought it was the Russians. The Russians thought it was the Americans and all the rest of that. Yeah. And when everybody calmed down, they realized that it was something else. And so there was a report done. And this report was that, in fact, they were, you know, if these guys wanted to take us out, they'd be able to do it. And they could have done it years ago.
I wonder if they can stop us taking ourselves out.
No, I don't think so. I think they're trying to. I think they, you know, they don't want this planet. You know, it's a good resource for us all, and they don't want to see it blitzed. But there's just a lot of very good information out there. Depends what kind of orientation. If you're into the scientific, then, you know, you can listen to people like Steve Colburn. You can look at Dr. Roger Lear material, who's removed the implants. You know, the tests and the analysis of the Starchild skull, those implants, they're not lying. And if you don't believe it after that, then, you know, there's no helping you in you know, kind of getting closer to the subject.
There would have to be a whole lot of people out there lying a whole lot in order for all of this to be not quite right. I must admit that one of the most fabulous resources I've come across recently was, again, was one of your guests. It was Grant Cameron, I think it's called.
Oh, he's amazing.
Is it called Presidential UFO or .com?
Presidential UFO.com is his website.
Yeah.
He's an amazing speaker. He's like a terrier. I love that guy. He is just so phenomenal. Mm. And he's got, you know, a great, great mind on him. And he brings his expertise and his, you know, he's like a super sleuth. What Grant did initially, because he had all these sightings when he was at college and then came out of college and decided to go and research this, he actually went to meet Wilbert Smith's wife. I think he'd already died at the time in the early 1960s. But, you know, Wilbert Smith was in touch with an off-worlder called AFA, and AFA and his team were part of the consignment of folks clearing our atmosphere, because, of course, what we have to remember is, in context back then, they'd still been detonating, you know, bombs for testing, and our atmosphere was heavily polluted, and they were clearing it. Mm. I mean, we don't know the great good that has been done by some of these others as well, who are supporting humanity quietly behind the scenes, you know, and there are the others who are, you know, think of humanity differently, but,
Grant Cameron was one of those as well, who was a definite non-believer until he saw the evidence with his own eyes, and then became effectively a bit of a nut for the subject, didn't he? And Wilbert Smith, I looked up, having listened to your show on the subject, I looked him up. He was a pretty senior government official in Canada, wasn't he? I mean, if you want a creditable source, he's another real goodie.
That's right. And again, there are some audio recordings of Wilbert Smith speaking himself, talking about the saucer people. He called them saucers back then. So go and check it out yourself. Don't listen to me. Don't listen to any of this. If you can't believe it, go and do a bit of legwork. Go and do a bit of finger work on the old keyboard. And, you know, if you don't come up with, you know, by being convinced after that, then, you know, you never will. You know, you've got people like Robert Hastings, and he's the guy who, he was testing some missiles, and these were, you know, to see how they'd go and the trajectory and all the rest of that. And then when he came back from the testing, he was called into a main office, and his top guy said, "Were you lot messing about?" He said, "No, I don't know what you're talking about," because they were filming it. And there was a blooming UFO, and the UFO knocked out the missile. Now, Robert Hastings wouldn't have seen that from his perspective down on the ground. And he didn't have the film. The film was, you know, then taken by the bigwigs, and they showed it. And so, you know, and he now talks about this quite openly. And also you've got Robert Salas, who talks about how there was a UFO hovering outside some of the nuclear silos, switching off the codes, or scrambling the codes, or basically standing the nukes down.
I think that's really great, because I remember having a dream as a young man, and in the dream we were approaching a nuclear holocaust. Everybody's fingers were reaching for the buttons. And when they pressed the buttons in the dream, there was just a resounding click and nothing happened, which I thought was really great. I enjoyed that one a lot.
Yeah, There have been, by the way, the odd UFO story where they've actually switched them on.
Right.
But
they
that's
do,
rare.
They do seem to be pretty interested in the nuclear side of things, don't they?
The really great interest seems to have come from their bombs. It's definitely, there's been a huge rise in activity since the bombs. It's really interesting. You know, and also, if somebody wants to be convinced, go and listen to Charles Hall, or read his books called Millennial Hospitality. There's about three of them. And they are all about, this guy was in the US Army, and he was sent out. He was a weather guy, so a meteorological guy. And they'd have a posting, like a 2-year posting, in this isolated part of Indian Springs. And so he was sent out. He was given a briefing. And from this guy he was taking over from, he said, you're likely to see, what do they call him? Something Charlie. Gosh, I've forgotten the name they called him. Anyway. So this was essentially a lone job. He was out in this little place, and he no colleagues. His job was to monitor the weather and send back reports and blah, 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 over a period of time, different situations and circumstances. And then it became obvious that he wasn't alone. And he wasn't alone because there was another group of people living nearby, and these were what he called the tall whites. And these tall people, as they got older, they got taller, and they lived a lot longer than we do. But they, their younger ones, would try and integrate. They were not a million miles from Las Vegas, and now and again, to kind of familiarize themselves with human ways and systems and society, they would go as far as they could incognito out into society and you know, whatever. But he talks about them taking shuttles of people to the moon, you know, and he's talking. I mean, this guy's not crazy. I mean, I know this sounds fantastic. I know it does. But this guy spent 2 years on the range. I think it was called Range Harry, something like that, or Range Charlie. I've forgotten the exact nickname that they gave to one of the tall whites out there. It was a very tricky relationship, because they were very, very protective of their young, and they were super protective against humanity. And so it would have been very easy for him to have lost his life. He had to be extremely careful how he dealt and interacted with these people, because there were certain things details, which if he didn't adhere to, they would have killed him. Yeah. No two ways about it. But otherwise, they managed an ongoing relationship and even to some degree, a little bit of society.
Mm. I think that's really great. I mean, even if nobody else is going to be going through the podcast of this show, making a note of all those names and looking into them, I will be. You're going to cost me a fortune in books, you are.
Well, you can listen to it free on YouTube and all the rest of that, you know.
Yeah.
You can go and enjoy those, as there's plenty. There's so much material out there, guys, and really good, credible stuff. You know,
well, I think downloading the YouTubes is really great for me because I've got an MP3 player, and when I'm out in the gardens during the day, I listen non-stop really to people's internet radio. So it'd be great to introduce a bit of variety. Do you know what? We've already covered the hour and a half that we planned to talk. I don't know whether you're willing to come back on for a bit after a music break, or are you an
early... I tell you what, I need a cup of tea break is what I need.
Okay.
I'll come on I can do that if you want to continue. I don't mind.
No, that
definitely need to wet the whistle.
That'd be great. Can I ask one or two more questions from the chat box before we go to a bit of music?
Sure.
When we were talking about the direct message to the brain and things like that.
Yeah,
and
voice
to skull stuff and Mike Smith's wires that disappeared into the wall. Wally asked a question. He said, can you ask if Joanne knows about passing matter through fibre optic LED from one point, making it appear at another point?
Well, I don't know specifically about that, Wally, but I do know, that something called a port is an object that has been passed from one dimensional frequency to another, from one room to another. And, you know, the early spiritualists were very adept at, you know, doing that. So the modern version would be perhaps what ET are doing now, but I'm not sure what you're referring to, Wally, but that sounds very interesting. And I do know that, you know, BT are doing some interesting stuff like this soul capture research.
Hmm. Yeah. And I guess it doesn't seem entirely unlikely to me if the technology is as far ahead of the reported technology, then the business holograms and stuff and fiber optic cables may well end up, it appears to me, end up being connected with each other. We had a question from Laurie, from our main admin, and we were
Hi, Laurie.
Hello, Laurie. She was asking whether you think the indoctrination that's going on is, would you classify it as NLP or MK Ultra? That'll keep you busy for a while.
Do you mean indoctrination of what by ET generally, by their interaction with humanity generally over the years?
I think so, because I think that's what we were talking about at the time. I've been making a note of these as we've gone along.
Well, I'll tell you that there's definitely been some MK Ultra stuff going on because, again, let me just come back to Mike. Mike suffered horrendously at the hands of the British Army, and maybe with the help of the Americans, because he was on a base that was allied to Area 51. They had techies there that had Honest John rockets. But they were in a different part of the camp. And Mike was going off to, he decided that he would sign up to do a flu test. Now, this is 1968, folks. So bear in mind the context.
And he did, didn't he? He did sign up for a flu test.
The thing is, he said, Joanne, I know I was going to do it, but I don't even remember signing up. He said he signed up, but he said, I actually, in hindsight, don't remember even doing that. And bearing in mind he was in Germany, he said, the next thing I knew, he believes it's Porton Down, and someone else has been speaking to me, and they think it is Porton Down also, because in those days, it did indeed have the kind of Nissen huts you mentioned. And also, they did some horrific mind control on him, which impacts him to this day, which is basically a kill program. But thank God for all of us and for Mike, because he'd hate to have that on his conscience, because he's not that kind of a guy. He hasn't ever done it because he's got a will of iron. But they have tried to make him a killer, and he's just not followed through. And they also try to inculcate him with pretty revolting sexual stuff. It's very, you know, deviant kind of stuff. And this was part of the mind control. And bless him, Mike doesn't read very well because he's dyslexic and because he had no education. So when they were foisting these books on him, which, by the way, folks, I checked out on the net, and there they were still. And when I told, and one of them was called, My Mother Taught Me. And he said, they were called greenbacks. And when I did a bit of research, this is in the book, but you can check this out now. My Mother Taught Me was available for a £1.49 download from Amazon. I didn't download it, but he said greenbacks were the books that were a bit like the top shelf brown paper stuff.
Yeah.
And it's of a sexual nature and incest and stuff like that. And stuff I don't, you know, we won't lower the vibration anymore. But anyway, the fact is this poor chap was given, he was taken from the camp on two or three occasions by Americans wearing kind of Chicago gangster outfits, you know, the long coat, the hat. They were Americans, and they took him to bookshops. And Mike said, I don't even know if they, because they took me to different bookshops. He said, so I don't know how many American bookshops there are in Germany. He said, but I think I might have actually been in another space, you know. Anyway, and the last book that they gave him, folks, which is very interesting, was the one that is frequently found in assassins' bookcases. Oh, God, it's just gone out of my head. Oh, my God. I'll come back. Well, we'll leave it as a cliffhanger and I'll come back with that, to that one. But I'll remember it. But Lee Harvey Oswald had it, and other people have. And basically they use those as triggers a bit, you know, like the MK. So, Laurie, I'm not quite sure whether you mean E.T. certainly is using some kind of – they're not using NLP. Good grief. They're way beyond any kind of NLP. Humans may be using NLP on, you know, to keep people like, you know, Dr. John Hall and stuff like that, apart from the satellite terrorism bit of it, in tow or in line. But the ET are definitely manipulating. There's no question about it. But there are those who are service to others, who are standing by and trying not to let us make too much of an idiot of ourselves, and trying to help us develop in a way that they are not entraining us. They are rather educating us, but definitely a majority of human minds are being entrained. No two ways about it. But with ET, and I'm not talking about some of the highly negative stuff that's gone on, and we can say it's all relative, but is that there is this, yeah, indeed, there is this fallout of positive stuff. Again, as I mentioned with Steve last night, of, you know, heightened attributes of physicality, things in the physical, like stamina, IQ, psychic abilities, definitely.
Yeah, precognition seems to be quite common.
That's massive. Mm. It's absolutely huge, and people get quite scared about that. So I don't know what you want to call that, but there's definitely seems to be, you know, two sides of the coin in this tweaking of humanity. You know, I know I was listening to the Whitley Strieber book, Transformation, after his first one he wrote, Communion. Communion came out in the early 80s and Transformation followed along. And Transformation was the transformation of his going from fear to love of these others. But anyway, part of the story that I was listening to was interesting because he'd had an ET come and tell him that they wanted to talk to him about his death. And he was a bit perturbed about that. And they said, we have changed your metabolism, because he likes sweets. At that time, he was a sweetie man. He just loved his cookies, loved his biscuits, loved his sweets, loved his chocolate. And that's what he indulged in, you know. And they said, we've tweaked your metabolism. And if you have chocolate, you will die.
Oh.
And
they did what?
Yeah, how outrageous. I hope they don't ever tweak mine. God. But anyway, so he took no notice for a very long time. And then his wife said she had a very weird dream about the fact that he'd had this bar of chocolate and suddenly just dropped dead. And then they said, you will go on a journey in about, you know, a few months, whenever they said, and you will, one, you'll die, and the other, you'll live. You'll know it at the time. But anyway, hey, obviously he's living, and he understood the stopping of the sweets and the chocolate and stuff, because of course sweets and chocolate, and I mean, and I'm an indulgent too, more on the chalky stuff now and again, but of course it's quite acidic in our bodies. It can cause a lot of issues if we have excessive amounts of it, and you know, and from a health point of view, it can then create a breeding ground for really unpleasant conditions in the human body, which can lead to, you know, really really distressing conditions. Yeah. So it's very interesting. So they seem to be, they seem to feel that they have carte blanche to work on us and with us. Some will communicate, some will not, and just get on with the job of, you know, dealing with the creation of fetuses or teaching, you know, a guy, Jim Sparks. He's a, another interesting guy I'd love to have on the show. He's an American abductee, contactee. He began to take a great interest in the rainforests and began to I don't know if he actually set up a foundation or some kind of body of work to help restore the trees, which are the lungs of the planet, which we are happily destroying, and the chemtrails are happily destroying. So there is some intelligence going on here in our being programmed and tweaked and what have you. But, you know, we need to also, I feel, I quite passionately help the human beings or the beings who are having a traumatized experience and to help bring them to some kind of balance. So because of their trauma, they don't then kick off something in their body that's going to cause them issues or mental issues down the line, because it's a very hard world. It's really tough. And when you've got the ET issue on top, it is friggin' difficult, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to be working on so many different levels. It's a bit like a game of doubles tennis, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
So Laurie, well, I'm really not sure that I've answered your question at all, because it's not all one or sometimes anything like the one, but certainly MK Ultra is at play and all the same kind of thing. NLP is absolutely at play in the world. And I know they're using a lot of that in Agenda 21 programming and the UN, all of that, you know, street level stuff, sustainability, non-sustainability, all the rest of that, and the way they're trying to get us to, you know, live like sardines and pack us all up in little boxes. So there's NLP going on in various levels, but the ET staff, I think, they're way beyond NLP. They don't need any of that stuff. They just have, if I just read you, and maybe before you go to a break, I'll read you what Dr. Carla Turner, PhD, said. She's, and she was a woman who died very early. We think that she was killed, she was murdered, that a raging cancer was induced in her very quickly. She died quickly of it, and same with many others.
It is common, that, isn't it?
Yeah, and what she said was, aliens can, and this is a quote, aliens can take us, our consciousness out of our physical bodies, disable our control of our bodies, and install one of their own entities, and use our bodies as vehicles for their own, whatever they're doing, before returning our consciousness back to our bodies. She wrote Taken, which has been made into a film, and she wrote Masquerades of Angels and Back to the, I think it's called Back to the Fringe. I haven't quite got the list in front of me, but I think it was Back to the Fringe. Anyway.
Well, that's absolutely great, Joanne. I think you've well and truly earned a cup of tea. So I'll,
thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed that. And like I say, I'm looking forward to looking up some of those resources that you've mentioned. Oh, very, very helpful, I think. So I'm going to put on 10 minutes of music to make sure you've got plenty of time to go and get your tea and stuff, and give me a
great
bit of a break too. And we'll kick off the next music bit with Extraterrestrial Intelligence from the Blue Oyster Cult, which should do, shouldn't it? And I'll see you in 10 minutes or so. Thanks
all
a lot.
Right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Well, you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was What I Got from Sublime. And before that, I'm the Urban Spaceman from the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. Took a bit of a hit for playing that one. And previous to that, Come With Us from the Chemical Brothers. And I gather that Joanne's back on the line. You there, Joanne? Ooh, hang on. Oh. That was me pressing the wrong button. That was nothing to do with Joanne. Sorry, Joanne. Welcome back. Ooh.
Thank you. I don't know what happened then. I just heard you say, ooh.
Yeah, no, it was me. There's a green button here that I'm supposed to press, and something on my computer stopped me from pressing it. But it looks like we're all working now.
Okay.
By the way, Laurie said thank you very much for the answer to the last question. I think she really enjoyed that.
Okay, good.
I guess we might as well leap straight into the other. There've been some interesting questions in the chat box, actually. Got a couple from Angel. Again, when we were talking about this business of conditioning people and getting them to do what you want, mind controlling them. Angel put, could they fill your house with different smells?
They can pretty much seem to do whatever is necessary to get the result they want, basically. But also, we do, you know, it is possible that through our own heightened senses of awareness, that we too may get triggered to have scents or smells or, you know, scenes unfold. So this can be a natural outworking sometimes of us also having, if you like, it's that thinning of the veil business where we can almost hop from one dimension to another or momentarily experience something. But I would imagine that they could pretty well do that if they needed to.
Yeah, I would have thought so as well, because it is all a matter of frequency, and we're a matter of frequency, and of course we're completely and totally bathed in Wi-Fi now, and ever more so. So I guess that that could be used as well.
Yeah, Mike described the ways it works, and so that this can be a bit disconcerting. He said, just imagine that, you know, you're reaching for a cup of tea, and the next thing you know, you've drunk the tea, but you have no memory of going to pick up the cup, but you've done the action. You've completed the action. And he said, I couldn't honestly tell you if some of the things that I perceive to be true and have been done, or whether it's like a memory, like a projected memory. And this is very interesting. You know, we go into some very interesting territory here. And just as a slight sidestep, into a slightly different field, that of psychiatry. There's a great guy that I really hope I'll have on, as I said, who has been working with, he's a 30 year as a clinical psychologist, and he worked for 5 years with schizophrenic prisoners on a one-on-one. And what he found out was that the voices were real. So these were not delusions and were not imagination. They were real, independent entities. And he got to, he's just writing a book at the moment to show all of that. And then apparently there is a doctor, I think it might be Izak, I-Z-A-K, in Turkey, who independently has also come to the same conclusion and written a paper about this. Now, this is very interesting because there are definitely entity situations that piggyback humans. You know, we have to be quite careful of our, if you like, auric hygiene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where I also do quite a bit of my work, is making sure that the energy field is clear and secure, because it's very easy. You know, we get very sticky emotionally, and it's a bit like a bit of Velcro. You're hooked in, or something hooks into you parasitically, and before you know it, you can be thinking, is this my thought? Is that somebody else's? Or how does that work?
Which I guess is an important thing, isn't it? Is to be aware enough of the way we normally think to be able to spot stuff that's a bit unusual. Because obviously Mike Smith could do that if he could resist the instructions to kill and all the rest of it. It must be possible to recognize a thought that's not your own and resist it if you're strong enough.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, what he's been put through in his experience. I mean, it's like Steve was saying yesterday, it certainly toughens you up, because I said, did he think it was a spiritual journey? Because I think ultimately this is about, you know, honing the spirit of us, but also that there is something about us that is, you know, really important and useful for a number of bodies. And, you know, maybe it's not just the fact that we are hybrids ourselves, because we, you know, if we're genetically engineered, then we're hybrids.
Yeah.
Some of us are more hybrids than others, or more hybrid than others. But, you know, so where everything is in this mix at the moment is a bit like a jelly that hasn't set. There's all of these elements to it. And we're just trying to bring the dots together at the moment. But I tell you what, the astonishing thing is that although there may be similarities in people's testimonies and stories and experiences, they really are individual as well. It's quite, you know, mind-blowing what goes on and what people go through. And I am, you know, just ever impressed at the resilience of folks, as I've said. But I just wanted to flag up one of the earliest deaths, if you like, from involvement in this field, and that was an American called James V. Forrestal, and you can go and Google this guy. He was made the first Secretary of Defense by Truman, and that was in, I think we, where are we? 47, 49. I think it was in 47. So it would be a few months after the Roswell crash. That was it. It was in September 47. He ended up resigning in 49, just shortly before he threw himself out of a window or somebody pushed him. But there was something called MJ-12, also known as Majestic or Magic 12, and if you ever saw the film or the series called Dark Skies, which is actually really, really good, it's an old series, go and have a look at that. I think you can see it on YouTube. That's a really, that tells you a lot about, I think, you know, pretty much on the dot of how things are.
That sounds good.
Yeah, so it's called Dark Skies. Anyway, and apparently he was one of, now there were 12 members of MJ-12, and Vannevar Bush was one of them, and Vannevar Bush was a top scientist who was working with Wilbert Smith, amongst others. So we know where he was. He was, you know, definitely in with the craft thing, and they created MJ-12. Around 1947, the Americans are obviously really worried about security, national security. So they set up the NSA and CIA all in 1947. First Secretary of Defense, 1947, James V. Forrestal. He was an amazing guy, and I think he was only 57 when he died. But he basically was also a member of MJ-12, and I think he was shaken to his foundations by what he understood to be happening. And we don't know what that is, except that his mental health seemingly began to take a bit of a hit. So much so. So he was involved in also making sure the funding was in place for MJ-12. So he was privy to all that was going on, as well as all the other stuff at the time, which was the communist thing and whatever. So you can imagine what that might do to a mind. And so this guy was eventually escorted to the Bethsaida Naval Hospital, which was interestingly also the hospital where the JFK body was taken and where they deduced that he was definitely shot from behind. So, you know, isn't that interesting? And normally, if people are suicide watch folks, they wouldn't be set up on the 16th floor, which is where he was. And his And it looks like there was assailants. There seemed to be in the information like scuff marks around the area that he jumped from. So, you know, did he have a change of heart and try and pull himself back, and or was he just struggling? So we think there was a bit of a struggle. One of the other names on the list of MJ-12 was General Nathan Twining Sr. And this is a very interesting one, because he was one of the guys who was working, you know, very hard 24/7 to keep the lid on all of this. It's after the Roswell incident, you know, they had the craft thing out, saucer lands, and then all of a sudden it's a weather balloon, it's this, it's that, it's crash dummies that weren't even made at that time, all that kind of nonsense. So I think the American Air Force came up with about four different stories over a period of time, and people just lost interest in the end and didn't believe a word they said, and still don't in that regard. But anyway, what was interesting about that is that the lady I interviewed on camera, she's now 85, 86, she's actually 87 this year. Jo Walters contacted me about 2 years ago asking if she could send me a letter about her experience. And I thought this was really amazing that an Englishwoman was going to had something to tell me about an American event, a big, you know, iconic American event regarding UFOs. And she was a bit frightened to speak over the phone about it. Some people are at the beginning, and I'll meet them, so that can happen. I can meet you if you need an appointment. We'll do that. Anyway, so Jo sent me a letter, and she basically said that about 15 or 16 years ago now, she was planning on retiring out to America, and they were part of some kind of group, spiritually orientated. Anyway, but this, they'd been invited to stay over by the guy who was building the compound or whatever it was called. And this chap just happened to turn out to be Nathan Twining Jr. And so she fell into conversation. Her colleagues or friends were not at all interested in the subject, so she only had two occasions to speak to him. And she said he did seem quite fearful once he'd sort of unburdened himself. And his story was that his dad had all his life said, no, 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 son, every time he asked, it was whatever he said it was to him, but definitely nothing to do with ET. 6 weeks before he died, he said, look, I want to be straight with you. I have something to tell you. He said, Roswell was real. It was a real event. And he said, there were bodies. And he said, one survived. And he said, I came to look on that individual as a friend. And that individual lived for 15 years. And so nobody had ever had this story. So I interviewed Jo and she told that same story. It's not a huge big story, but she didn't keep in touch with him. She wished she had. But back in that time, she just didn't think of it and didn't think it was that important. Now she does. But anyway, so that's an amazing kind of bit of a scoop for us over here, because this older, and the reason that Jo came forward is that she was initially asked by Nathan Twining Jr. to keep this all a secret, which she did. She absolutely did for 15, 16 years. And then she knows that she believes that she's going to leave the planet this year. And she said, I really, you know, I'm a frail lady. I just wanted to pass it on. I don't think I should die with this knowledge. And she contacted me after she saw some newspaper article locally, you know, about Amash and what we were doing. So that was pretty amazing. So it's amazing how this stuff, you know, it doesn't die. It keeps coming up.
And it does leak out, doesn't it? Stuff
it
leaks out.
It keeps leaking, yeah.
I know they're really, really, they seem to be really good, the world management team, at keeping things secret. But they can't know about unintended consequences, and they can't know who's going to have a sudden burst of conscience on, you know, their deathbed.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, for those who are not sure whether any of this is true or not, they can also look up a guy called Phil Schneider. Now, Phil Schneider's an interesting case because I think it was the 1990s, and you can see one or two YouTube videos about him giving a talk. He was, I'm not sure I'm absolutely correct, something like a geologist or something along those lines. And basically, he was part of a team who were building underground bases.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that don't exist, right?
Yeah, we had a really brilliant interview on Open Your Mind Radio with Bob Fletcher about that recently. It's fabulous if you haven't heard it.
Oh, brilliant. You guys know about Phil Schneider?
He didn't mention Phil Schneider. He was talking about Nibiru, and he was talking about big underground bases, like cities. Over 100 of them just in the States.
Yeah. Mm. Well, what happened with Phil Schneider is that they went down, you know, they were roped up, ready to go down a hole, and there was something not right. And I can't remember the detail of that not rightness. Anyway, so they had some army guys with them, some military guys with them for like protection or whatever. But so Phil Schneider went down, and all he'd got was just his regular working suit. Coverall and that kind of thing. And he took a pistol down with him. And when he was let down in the basket, what he came face to face with was something like a 7-foot-tall reptilian. He said the stench was horrendous. The smell was just unbelievably horrendous. Anyway, this there ensued a firefight, you know, and he'd only got a little pistol. And this reptilian fired off whatever he had. He touched something on his, like the belt of whatever he was wearing, and it seared Phil Schneider's body. It melted off some of his fingers, his toes. It fair near sheared right into his lungs. And anyway, with that, a military guy was down the rope, and he took over and shoved Phil Schneider back in the basket and sent him back up half conscious. And that guy took on the firefight with this reptilian, only to die. They lost, I think they lost about 60 personnel that day.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a big deal to this firefight. Anyway, so then Phil Schneider started talking about it, and he would now and again show some of the wounds. I mean, you could see obviously that he doesn't have his fingers, and he said his toes were the same. He said he described them as crispy critters, so because they'd been toasted off, and his chest had been completely seared. And he said, you know, I don't want to gross out the ladies, but if you want to see what the, you know, what they did to my body, what the consequence of my body was. And he was very ill, you know, as a consequence of the outfall of the fight. But anyway, so he began to talk about the fact that there were aliens, there were reptilians and, you know, secret underground bases and on and on and on and on. And then he said, they're going to kill me. They've let me know that I'm not going to live much longer and they're going to kill me. And he became quite disabled with, I think it was MS in the end, in any event, but that, you know, the trauma to his nervous system, you know, it's going to kick off something big in the body. So anyway, he was found dead this is suicide, by the way, with his own catheter around his neck. So, you know, as they say, go figure. How does that one work?
So it is right what we say, isn't it? That if you do start going and looking at this stuff, it does remain extremely difficult to remain in denial.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got another couple of interesting chat box, really lively on the questions tonight. Wally again. Wally comes back. You know, do you think we need to worry about Wi-Fi in our kids' schools given all of this?
You know what? The thing is, Wally, we're in a situation and we have to work the best with what is. So, the short answer could be yes, but I've got a mobile phone. I use it. Wi-Fi, you know, I'm using Wi-Fi and yes, it gives off a lot of energy. But the thing is to counter that, the way we can counter that is making sure that if you can't do it every day, just do it every other day, take in some really strong nutrition, you know, get familiar with some very inexpensive, very cheap ways to stay well and to ground yourself in health. And also the intention is to, you know, raise your frequency. And that's not always easy, but it's a work in progress. So, you know, yes, if we'd had the Tesla technology, we'd have never had Wi-Fi or anything like that because we would be using the ambient energy. Where Tesla already in the, where are we? Late 1900s, early 1920s had already deduced a way to create global wireless network, global, which would not hurt us. It was using the ambient energy and electrical field of the earth. And there was no harm in that for us. It's like anything, you know, you use things responsibly. But as we are, as JP Morgan decided if he couldn't meter it, it wasn't happening. And so on. So we've got all this kind of technology that we're, you know, it is causing issues. It really is causing issues. And all I would say to health issues and mental stresses is be careful. Watch out for yourself. Become much more aware of your own health and wellness. And you don't need to become paranoid. You just check yourself. How am I doing? How do I feel? And I'm not saying about running off to the doctors. I don't mean that. I just mean, you know, take care of yourself.
Yeah. Yes, I think that I gather that Organite can be really helpful as well.
Yeah, apparently, and it's interesting. I have one or two pieces around the house. And if you guys want to check out the Dulwich Health Centre, I don't know if it's called the Dulwich Health Centre. It's a London-based, as in Dulwich, London-based group, and they've made Raditex, and it's basically a way of neutralising harmful earth energies, and some of them are a little bit expensive, but I've got a little one that will deflect negative electromagnetic fields more strongly probably than the organite also is good for that, but it's the little pieces I've got probably keep my energy field a bit clearer from anything that I might be attracting by the work that I'm doing. But the Raditech and the Magnetech from the Dulwich Health you're just going to have to check it out, guys, yeah. Online. I can't remember the exact name. Yeah. But if you put in Raditech or Magnetech and Dulwich, you'll come up with that. And that's Dulwich for Dulwich, the London place. And they're still going. And so things like that that you can do to just insulate yourself against further harm. And, you know, I also take diatomaceous earth, and diatomaceous earth, food grade, like I take food grade H2O2, that's hydrogen peroxide, but at food grade, extremely diluted, and you can use it as a cleaning agent to clean your vegetables, to sterilize things. And I also use it on myself. I take it in a little spray bottle and I don't get a cold generally. If I start with a sore throat or a cold, then a few sprays of that. And I've even forgotten I even had one. it's fantastic. All of these are inexpensive. The diatomaceous earth will trawl out parasitic heavy metal kind of stuff from the body. Cheap and cheerful, all of this. So, you know, just, you don't need to do a huge amount. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, but I can't afford all the organic stuff, so never mind. The power of intention is really profoundly effective.
I was just going to point that out, that actually all of these things are probably effective in themselves, but just by doing them, you're making clear your intent, which is in itself going to make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, sometimes we get so stressed, we need some material thing in our environment to help us because we get tired. I get tired. So I'm very grateful to have my H2O2 to have a spray when I'm too tired to do my mental imaging and therapy stuff on myself, because sometimes I'm just too cream crackered.
It has to be said, with the kids in schools, I was looking, because I'd seen an article about a school in America, I can't quite put my mind on where it was at the moment, where a teacher had had a heart attack, basically, and there was also apparently people were bleeding from their ears and things like that, and it was said that they weren't allowed to file an incident report on it, and it was accompanied by a photograph of, I think it was somewhere over 30 children all sitting on the floor in this classroom, and every single one of them was holding an iPad. You just think, my goodness, you'd really have to be working quite hard, because the amount of Wi-Fi in such a space. And I remember when I first got a laptop, reading a report which said the only way they could make these things, you shouldn't sit with them on the lap, you should have them on the table. And the only way they could make them more dangerous is if they made them so that you could hold them in their hands. And less than a year after I read that article, we had these iPads and other carry around Wi-Fi devices. But I think your point is taken nonetheless, that there are things we can do about it, and just making the attempt actually makes a difference.
And you know, throw out your microwave, get rid of it.
Definitely. And your television.
Well, yes, I don't have a TV either.
No, that is real progress, I think, because we haven't had a telly for the best part of 20 years, and we were unusual 20 years ago, whereas now it's getting to be ever more common, I think, for people not to have anything to do with that. On the subject of vegetarianism, Lee, as usual, has proved to be pretty synchronistic. Just before you came up with that, he put in a question. He said, would being around blood and meats be more conducive to these parasites you were talking about than, say, someone who surrounds themselves with incense or sweet aromas rather than being within the vicinity of dead flesh, cooked or otherwise?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Well, you know what? It really ultimately is about frequency and your intention. You know, I work with some learning difficulties folks, and sometimes I need to make a meal for them, and sometimes it's with meat. And, you know, I prefer not to touch it. I prefer not to have anything to do with it. But the intention is that this is nutritional material for them. And that's, you know, that's fine. It's your, you know, really intention is important here. If you want to look at some intention experiments, have a look at Larry Dossey, Dossey. He was a medical doctor. And he was on the Oprah Winfrey Show some donkey's years ago. I used to do, I did a teaching qualification for adult ed, and I wanted to see if my workshops on healing and this, all this kind of information was kind of meeting the national, you know, edict of protocols and whatever. So that's why I did the thing. But anyway, it was very interesting because I used to use as part of my demonstration just a little snippet of the Larry Dossey thing, because you know, you can call it prayer. I don't call it prayer, but I call it power of thought and mind. But if you have that overtone to your life and you want to call it prayer, that's great. Doesn't matter. The fact is it's the same. And he was just talking about the ultimate test was getting meditators to meditate on bacteria, and it was an open-ended prayer. He said he found that the open-ended prayer or thought process was the best one. And so they said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, intend that not to be a specific outcome. You know, you're not giving it an outcome. What you're giving, say, for the bacteria or the plant or whatever it was, is that may the highest and the best develop for this being, entity, creation, peace, whatever, and just hold that intention. So you don't know what the outcome is going to be, except the best for it, because you don't know what the it is going to be, that bacteria. You know, you might know that a plant's going to grow bigger and stronger and what have you. But so that just goes to show you that whatever material you're with, whatever it is, whether it's meat, blood and guts and all the rest of it, You know, if you're an emergency room doctor, you'll be around a lot of that. You won't necessarily draw it, but you might if you too get traumatized, and then your frequency goes lower and you begin to attract in other entities. You know, I used to do a little bit of rescue work, spiritual rescue work, for want of a better term. It's not a very good term. But anyway, to support other discarnates who were kind of just, they'd lost the roadway, you know, and to stop them, you know, being a pain to folks down here. And that was just a matter of frequency, raising the frequency. And again, it's a slightly, you know, sideways thing, this, from the subject, but it all feeds into this enormous field that is, you know, the subject that we're dealing with. There are enormous offshoots to it.
Yes, and I've been recommending, because I've been recently rereading Lynn McTaggart's Intention Experiment.
Oh, I went to that. I went to her big workshop, conference in, was it 2006 or 7 or 8, something like that.
Yeah.
When they had Hal Puthoff, they had William Tiller. Oh my God, folks, have a look at William Tiller. He is the most amazing scientist. He's phenomenal. When we did a meditation right at the end to kind of wrap everything off, they'd got Edgar Mitchell there, Hal Puthoff, who's a scientist. So Hal Puthoff did a lot of work with remote viewing. He that Stanford University, he was the main scientist behind that, all of that stuff. Anyway, when William Tiller he was part of the group, I could feel his meditation focus like a searing light as he beamed it out into the room. And it was absolutely his. It wasn't, an aggregate one from everybody. It was his. And I went up to him afterwards and said, wow, because it was beautiful. I said, thank you so much. That was astonishing. I felt it was like a little tractor beam of love and light and just harmonious energy. It was gorgeous. So that tells me that guy is a very, very high functioning individual. And if people haven't seen What the Bleep Do We Know, which was a movie from around about that time, 2006-07, they have a bunch of scientists, a load of scientists talking about the power of thought. It was all around kind of the time of The Secret, if people know what I'm talking about, The Secret, yeah. About the power of it, you know, law of attraction. But even if you don't go for the law of attraction, it doesn't always work because other components aren't in place. You'll see William Tiller and some other amazing scientists like Frederick Wolff talking about, you know, the quantum world and getting it, you know, focusing it down so we can kind of wrap our little brains around it. It's amazing. I just want to share something with you guys. I picked up a book off my shelf just in the tea break, and it's called Behind the Flying Saucers by a guy called Frank Scully. And isn't it interesting that his name is Frank Scully? This guy was a journalist. The book is 1950, published by Victor Golantz Limited, London. And of course, Scully was the name of the character in The X-Files.
It was.
Nothing for no reason. So it's based on a real guy. And what this book's about, partially, is a report about an anonymous scientist who turned up at a university in America to talk about stuff. And here's a little bit of what was reported, which I'll be reading. Well, he was saying, to begin with, that there is such a thing as a flying saucer. He was saying, moreover, that the Air Force, despite its announcement to the contrary, had not abandoned its Project Saucer, but was operating on another level and under possibly another name. He was saying that four of these flying saucers had actually landed on Earth. Three of the four, he added, had been captured and had been inspected by men with whom he was currently identified in geophysical research. 34 men, measuring between 36 inches and 40 inches in height, had been found dead in three of the four saucers recovered. The first saucer to land on this earth, he said, landed less than 2 years previous to his talks. So that's 1948, so we know it's 1947, on a site within miles of Denver. The saucer not only didn't appear to come from any part of the earth, but the question of where it had come from still remained unsolved. The best speculation, he added, was Venus, but he continued to stress the point that it was still wide open to question. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this was a guy who addressed a few at lunchtime, students, high-end students at a university, and left quickly under some fear of security for himself, but really wanted to share that with up-and-coming people in the education system. So that's from 1950, and that's what Frank Scully reported.
1950, eh?
Yeah, and if people want to have a look at some of the earlier stuff, and I'm getting a lot of breathing from your mic. I don't know if you can hear it yourself, Dr. Rock, but it's just a bit...
Yeah, I don't think it can be me. Hang on, can you still hear it?
No, not now.
Oh, very good. Yeah, sorry about that. I do occasionally get a bit close.
Yeah, no, I didn't know it was something else feeding in. Anyway, also, there's something called OOP art, which stands for out of place art or artifacts. And people can go check this out. You know, if you still are not convinced that things and beings and others are visiting this planet, go and check out some of the ancient cave art, which absolutely, unquestionably shows ET. Now, if we believe that the cavemen from thousands upon thousands, 20s and tens of thousands of years ago, were painting what they saw, like the bison and like whatever, why would they suddenly paint something spurious or odd like a spaceman? Well, of course they wouldn't. They were painting what they saw. Go and have a look.
Yes, because they were essentially realists, weren't they, in their representations?
I would say that those guys probably didn't know any better, and they just were reporting verbatim by picture what they had seen.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we have to remember that we've got the Dogon tribe of West Africa near Mali, who were discovered by two French anthropologists in the 1930s, or at least they worked with them in the 1930s and became privy to their secrets. And part of the secrets were that these guys, the Dogon tribe, that is, I don't think they used writing or reading like we do, or I don't know if they do now, but they didn't then. And they took these two French anthropologists into their confidence and told them about their ancient history. And part of their ancient history involved Sirius, the star Sirius, and they also described and drew out in the sand for them Sirius B and C. Now, in the 1930s, we, modern people, had no knowledge of Sirius B and C, but the Dogon tribe did.
Mm. Yeah, yes, indeed, and I know somebody tried to debunk that, and the debunkers were debunked, as far as I know.
Absolutely, a load of nonsense. Well, yeah. You know, the fact is that B and C was discovered... I think it might have been the 1970s. I mean, loads later, lots later. Anyway, so, and if people are interested, you know, I'm fascinated quite by some of the 1950s experiences. People like George Van Tassel in Giant Rock. There was a guy I met at one of the conferences called Robert Short, and he was an amazing guy, absolutely extraordinary guy. And he was saying he used to go out and see George Van Tassel. And basically, Van Tassel, they'd have communication with, you know, other beings. So this wasn't like abduction. This was contact. Ships would land. People would come from all over the place to go to the George Van Tassel area of Giant Rock. I mean, it really was just by a giant rock. That's why it was called that. And then you'd have people like Adamski, George Adamski.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who allegedly took photos of kind of like a bit like a wedding cake. Craft, a bit like some of the Billy Meyer ones. Billy Meyer is this Swiss farmer who really, back in the, I think it was the 70s, he first began his interaction with these guys. And he took loads of not only photographs, but videos as well. And he talked about a lady called Semyasi who would come and speak to him. And this guy lost his arm on a trip in India. One of his arms, and so he would go one-armed, you know, on his little motorbike to wherever the designated meeting place was, and again, you know, meet up and speak to them about all kinds of things that was going on for Earth. And Billy has been famous, though he's not well known over here, really, for a lot of the prophecies, and they're called the Henoch prophecies, I believe, and apparently quite a lot of those is Michael Horn, who is a representative for Billy in the US anyway, has pointed out a great number of those. So this prophetic ability and about what is going on for humanity is, you know, really an astonishing angle, if you like.
Yes, and, you know, showing things that not just prophesying things in general, but I remember Billy Meyer was prophesying things that are of considerable, you know, specific interest, things like unnatural climate change.
Yes.
TVs in the home, computers and the internet, the Gulf Wars. He named AIDS, didn't he?
Yeah.
He predicted plastic cards, a dictatorship, another dictatorship in Europe, which I suppose is what we're seeing. Phones that you could carry around, biochips, the BP disaster, Fukushima, and all quite specifically, as far as I remember, because again, I looked into him after your show about him as well.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it again in, and you'll know this anyway, if you said you've looked into it, that when I spoke to the guy who started off the International UFO Congress, Bob Brown, that he reported how the two major American associations to do with UFOs and all the rest of that torpedoed the Billy Meyer story because both wanted to have exclusivity and so they just killed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Ego.
It is, but there's, I mean, he's got more stuff out there than anybody else, and even though only a small portion of it is actually published in English, there's still plenty of stuff to get your teeth into Billy Meyer.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, there's an awful lot.
Well, there you go. We've reached the witching hour, Joanne.
Wow.
I'd like to thank you very much for what's been for me a very, very easy and relaxed conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it and I'm really looking forward to hearing the pod.
Yes, let me know when that's out.
Yes, I'll do that. It does take me a bit of time generally because I'm sort of limited as to on-air time and batteries. Well,
listen, you, me, both.
Yeah.
But, just as and when.
In the meantime, you know, really thank you very, very much for coming on to the show. And your show is on... Tuesdays
from 11 till 1.
Right, and I know you've got lots of interesting stuff coming up. I'm hoping we're going to hear from the people that are making hopefully a much better documentary about Amash. I'm hoping we're going to hear from that Scandinavian lady who's been working with you for 6 months and is doing some sort of dissertation on this subject.
Yeah, that's Mia. Yeah, she's back in Denmark, and I think she's just getting stuck into that. And down the line, it's obviously going to be a few months yet before we have that. But I've got a couple of young guys who are interested in doing some kind of little pilot about Amash and, you know, what
Brilliant.
That is.
I really want to hear from the biolocation people as well, the people who are using dowsing. That would be really
Oh, my God. You know what? Those guys blow me away. And I'm just trying to arrange some interviews with them because... Wow, when you hear what they can do and what they have been doing, it's like jaw-dropping stuff.
Well, dowsing is amazing, isn't it? Because you really are using other parts of the brain. You're tuning in. I know that work's been done with Hamish Miller when he was still alive, where they attached electrodes to his brain and got him to go and douse a stone circle, and it was quite clear that he was functionally completely different when he slipped into his dowsing mode. So,
right. Well, I hadn't been really at all into dowsing. It just really didn't interest me at all. But when I was contacted by one of the team and they said, we can douse for abductees, we can douse for craft, we can actually bring a hologram down of the craft and we can tell you what it's made of and what's on the ship and what beings are there, and we can read the insignia, we can draw it, we can know about the, you know, chemistry and the chemicals and all the rest of that. I went, really? Through dowsing?
Yeah.
And so I'm a convert, I have to say.
Yeah.
And I've a lot to learn about it yet, but I can't wait to get those guys on.
Oh, look, Lee's trying to get, because No Holds Barred's normally on after the show, but I'm not sure we've heard from them. So Unique Lee, at 3 minute past the end of the show's trying to pose a last question if you happen to answer that. He's asking, when are the Pleiarans, Pleiadians going to decloak? I'm sick of waiting for them.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let's send a cosmic email and just say, hey, guys, come on. We're all getting tired.
Yeah.
We all want to, the powers that be to, you know, shift off and let's get some proper work done, proper living done.
Absolutely. Very good answer, I think, to that one. Well, stick with the technology, mate. That's what I say. You'll get through it, and do keep up with the Amash show, and keep lining up these fabulous guests you're getting. I really look forward to it every week. So,
well, thanks for your encouragement.
It's all right. Well, thanks very much for joining us on the Dr. Rock Show. Hopefully, once I've listened to a few more of your pods, perhaps you'll come back for a while and we can talk some more, because I know there's a few things we didn't get to tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, I hope the listeners enjoyed it, and I hope it's given you some food for thought, and go and do a bit of research and then come back and have a chat.
Yeah, we've got a good bit of feedback in the chat box here, and thank you very much. I'm going to play one more tune for them, I think, given that 50,000, I was told earlier on in the chat box by Lee that 50,000 people on Wall Street have been apparently made redundant, which must have caught them by surprise.
Whoa!
I'm going to play a song which does have the F word in it, so it might offend the easily offended, but it's by Jean Burnett, and it's called Jump, You Feckers, Jump. A big thank you very much from me and from Joanne, I'm sure, and I'll see you
absolutely.
I'll see you all next week. Here's the closing tune. Thanks for being there, folks.